Welcome to the Unified Republic of Stars, episode 2.11, Kanagawa and Yamanashi, the worlds of the new Nippon star system. I'm your host and story world creator, Colin Andrew Firm. So originally I was going to end the season here. I have one more rivalries written, and it's a fun little tale I thought would be a strong way to go out. But then, I just couldn't end this season without going into one, or really two more topics that have almost been ignored up until this point. The Japanese worlds of new Kanagawa-ken and new Yamanashi-ken. And that's because I've mentioned them over the course of these two seasons. Oh man, have I mentioned them. I even mentioned them just in the last episode when I was talking about the Japanese royal family in contrast to the Catholic Church. But did I really go into who or what any of that was? Did I go into any detail when I used them as an example in the transportation episode? Did I explain why their banks were back during the financial crisis when every other world but Darwin's weren't? No. Beyond mentioning that they were mostly Japanese settled and have some royals on it, I've barely touched on them at all, but that's something I intend to correct this week. So let's just jump into it, shall we? Officially, the two worlds of the new Nippon system are called New Kanagawa-ken and New Yamanashi-ken, which essentially means New Kanagawa or Yamanashi Province or County. And at their founding, that was essentially how they were ruled, as provinces or counties of Japan. But really, everyone just calls them Kanagawa and Yamanashi. But sharp-eared listeners might be asking, ruled? I thought the colonies didn't have any government. And that's true. Officially. Officially, no nation was supposed to lay claim to any colonial world, but unofficially, there was nothing the UN could do to stop people from adhering to the wishes of their home nation. Now, on most worlds we've talked about, no one did this. I mean, why? On most other worlds, people were leaving to get away from their home nations, so no one would. But besides the new Nipponese worlds, there were really only two other exceptions to this rule. One was Darwin, where people weren't so much escaping Australia as much as taking advantage of the country's administration and the relatively orderly settlements they were establishing. The other was Yeongnam, where the Democratic People's Republic of Korea established an extension of their slave labor camp nation out there. And let's face it, North Korea has never really much cared for what the UN thought anyway. But Kanagawa and Yamanashi were different, and they had several advantages for the Japanese government going in that Darwin, especially, didn't have. Now, before I get too deep, let me just say that I love the Japanese. I love the people, I love their culture, I sure as hell love their history. So anything that might sound like a criticism isn't really so much of that as much as an outsider's perspective into their culture. And again, like the religion episode, if anyone, especially someone from Japan, wants to correct me or flesh out some of what's going to be discussed, please contact me and I'll make sure it's on the site and update the podcast with this new information. So with that out of the way, what were the advantages that Japan had in setting up their own colonies in the Star Cluster? Well, the majority of it was cultural, and a big part of that is their insularity. Following World War II, a lot of people think of it as nationalistic, but I believe that the nationalism was a reflection of their insularity. They spent 1,000 years almost cut off from the rest of the world, and with the Meiji Restoration, they opened up to trade and modern technology. They still really kept to themselves. It was a kind of Japan-first mindset. Even after World War II, they still have it. The whole Gaijin thing? Yeah, it's a real thing. And to back this up, I'll share a personal anecdote, which is that my dad used to work for a bank in San Francisco that had been bought by the Bank of Tokyo. Naturally, they sent some of their executives over to run the place. Now, and maybe this is making the story a little complex, but the Bank of Tokyo was an international bank. They didn't have much of a presence in Japan itself. Whereas, the Bank of Mitsubishi was all over the place in Japan. And that matters, because just like in the US where the Fed forced several banks to merge so that they wouldn't fail, the same thing happened in Japan almost 20 years ago. Now, of the executives sent to my dad's bank, one was a guy most companies in most countries would consider to be a superstar. The guy spoke English, Spanish, Portuguese, probably more. And according to my dad, he was a hell of a guy to work with. The problem was, when he got back to Japan, because he'd been a Bank of Tokyo executive and thus pretty international, and because his Japanese and way of living had been inflected with aspects of the places he'd lived, he wasn't considered Japanese anymore by the Bank of Mitsubishi executives locally, and his rocket up the ladder basically hit the skids. Now, obviously, if you're a Japanese international executive, this kind of thing really hurts you. But if you're the Japanese government and want to set up a pretty much Japanese-only colony, this is to your advantage. After all, not wanting to deal with non-Japanese really hurts the prospects of a gaijin who tries to set up on your world. Maybe to the point they might voluntarily relocate elsewhere. Also, they had their beloved emperor on their side, showpiece that he was. I mean, if you think the English love their queen, it's nothing compared to the Japanese and their emperor. So the Diet was smart when they decided on their colonization plan. They chose the worlds they discovered, hence their Japanese names and ethnicities, and they, through law, established two minor seats of the imperial house. They put one on Yamanashi, considered the best of the two planets for reasons I'll go into, and the first in line to the throne, and they called it the Cherry Blossom Seat. They put the other on Kanagawa for the second in line, and called it the Mountaintop Seat. And not only did they ship their royals out to occupy these worlds, but they encouraged the Japanese people to flock out there as well under the imperial banner. And it was a raging success. In the first year alone, in 2111, both worlds had almost 1 million people. In 10 years, Kanagawa had almost 15 million and Yamanashi 11. This made Kanagawa more populous than Galileo, Athena, Columbus, and Troy combined. The only world with more population was Algarabia because of the almost literal exodus of people leaving Earth's Middle East. And because so many Japanese had settled these worlds, and the Japanese were so insular, almost no one else could get a real foothold there. And even if they tried, it didn't last for long when they couldn't trade with their neighbors. So even though the new Nipponese worlds weren't officially Japanese colonies, they were in every other way but title. The people on each world actually paid their taxes, but also, unlike a lot of other UN tax schemes we've discussed, it wasn't entirely selfish. A full third of it stayed on the world for their local administration. And that's why, in episode 2.8, the banks there were safe from collapse, because there were Japanese citizens in essentially Japanese colonies paying Japanese taxes. So the Japanese government back on Earth extended all of the same protections to the banks out in the colonies. Now, let's talk about the differences between the worlds. And let's start with Yamanashi as the home of the Crown Prince of Japan. Yamanashi is a very Earth-like planet. It's very temperate, with wet and rainy winters, and springs, and summers known for short but intense thunderstorms. During the fall, it gets almost no rain and is considered the ideal time to visit. What most visitors remark on is the sheer number of cherry trees that have been planted in the fields beat back from the native vegetation, planted in honor of the cherry blossom seat. Unfortunately, the native life isn't very far away. Because the native trees weren't very useful for lumber, and the indigenous vines that seemed almost everywhere not very appealing, it was cut back to make way for farms and the cherry trees I just mentioned. But when one spring, the vines blossomed, the settlers there went on a bit of a rampage to cut it back as far as possible. Because though the flowers the vines produced were exceedingly pretty, the scent they released has been described as day-old liver and onions carried by the wind. And the sheer amount of these vines meant that for 2 weeks, every human gagged every time they went outside. This taming of the world was aided by the fact that the vines tended to explode when set fire to. It's believed that this was an evolutionary thing, so that the vines could spread their seeds in event of a wildfire or lightning strike, but it really just aided in helping the humans push it back to the hills and mountains of the world. So, when the bloom still happens, it's no one's favorite time of the year, but at least, the old-timers will tell you, it's not as bad as it used to be. The capital city on Yamanashi is Nusuma, centered around a grand plaza on which sits the actual Cherry Blossom Seat Palace itself. It was built starting in 2113 with funds from a voluntary levy the people of Yamanashi placed on themselves, and when it was done, had the title of the largest complex of any built in the colonies thus far. Unfortunately for the Crown Prince, because it was in the center of the city and over half of it served mostly as a museum, it was unable to expand and, as I'll tell you about in a minute, was nothing for the holder of the mountaintop seat to envy. Beyond its museum function, it also has a private residence for the Crown Prince and a throne room. Interestingly, no one may approach any closer than 10 meters to the throne, but the demarcation line is only noticeable by marks in the rug leading up to it that only those who know to look for them would even notice. But Imperial Guardsmen also stand nearby so as to keep off-worlders from getting too close. Now, Kanagawa, as a planet to settle, is kind of a more interesting place, at least cosmologically. First of all, it's the most interior planet, meaning that the average temperatures would, you'd think, be much higher and make it a much more difficult place to live. But Kanagawa has a quirk. it's tidally locked to its star, which means that, like our own moon, one side always faces it while the other side never does. But because it does this around a star and not a planet orbiting a star, it very literally has a light and dark side, unlike the misnamed dark side of our moon, which will face the sun every 15 days or so. This has several effects on the planet. The biggest of which is that one side is really close to being blistering hot, while the other side, to quote Black Francis, is not. But this means that Kanagawa is very often subject to severe weather, as pressure within the atmosphere shifts from high to low, hot to cold, back and forth. Most human settlers have chosen to settle in the twilight areas, the areas that are pretty much in between the day and night sides, and never really see full darkness or sun except during the peaks of summer or winter seasons. However, there are cities that exist fully on the night side, and more than a few small communities that exist on the day side. But because most of the population lives in either the twilight areas or the night side, it means that Kanagawa is the only other place in the colonies where vertical gardens are commonly found. And in case I haven't mentioned them, vertical gardens are essentially multi-story tall greenhouses. Athena began using them as a way to provide fresh fruit and vegetables to its booming population that lacked the necessary land to set up farms and orchards. Kanagawa uses them because on the night side or twilight regions, there just isn't enough sunlight to raise transplanted earth crops. So because of this, Kanagawa is the only place where its vertical gardens are artificially lit all day long. Now, living on either side, day or night, is a hefty chore. On the day side, the only real native plant life that can survive in the constant exposure to sun and the dry soil is a tough, reedy type of grass. It also had a type of small, burrowing creature that lived beneath the ground, but even by the Republican period, these had been mostly exterminated by escaped hogs brought from Earth. On the night side, they had to deal with a different kind of species. Almost the size of a small person when standing on hind legs, there was a kind of animal that seemed to mostly hunt in streams for the fish-like creatures that swam in them, but they were known to attack humans when threatened. These were deemed fearful enough that they were hunted and pushed away from the population centers. But they're still known to exist in large numbers, and have even taken a liking to transplanted Earth creatures, to have adapted to tracking and killing things like escaped hogs, wandering dogs and cats, but especially rats. But beyond those animals brought from Earth and humans themselves, transplantation was a bit of a chore. Earth vegetation had an enormously difficult time adapting to Kanagawa because of the lack of sun, or because of too much of it. And because of this, Earth vegetation has never really done well except in the controlled environments like vertical gardens. Thus, they're a major importer of food like Athena, and otherwise survive on the livestock, which has been really successful in transplanting, and native root vegetables that are sparse, slow-growing, but hardy. Now, the mountaintop seat was built in a ridge of mountains that separate the day side from the night side, just inside the twilight region shared by the city Mobara. Just like the Cherry Blossom Palace, it was funded by a self-levied tax, but it was built slightly later, from 2120 until 2135. Now, this construction time represented the truly epic scale that was the palace being built. It was built into the steps of a mountain range overlooking Mobara, and featured a manicured courtyard that stretched for a full kilometer toward the dayside before even reaching the palace itself. Now, the palace, unlike the Cherry Blossom Palace, was not an imposing structure from the outside. Instead, it looked, really, like no more than a one-story stone building with some grandiose doors. More like a bunker someone had put some strange appointments onto. But it was built into the mountainside several stories down, each level featuring its own Japanese garden facing out on the view towards the dark side of the planet. And each level featured a different color scheme and theme, each decorated with priceless artifacts from the home country. The throne room is the second floor down, and features the actual throne of the mountaintop seat, backdropped by the stunning view of Mobara and the fading light behind it. It's been described as absolutely epic. And the reason that the mountaintop seat has nothing to envy for the cherry blossom seat is that the actual residence occupies the bottom two floors of the palace, unlike the cherry blossom seat residence, which is merely a third of a relatively small place. Now, I want to talk about two things here that are more or less related. Who gets what seat when, and the revolution. But let's take the second thing first, because it has the larger effect, and certainly affects the first. When the revolution got going, right around 2168, when all the planets began either actively deposing the UN appointees on their world or politely asking them to leave, the Cherry Blossom and Mountaintop seats united to back the movement. After all, they had been on the planets, and they had seen what was happening. And although the UN appointed a Japanese governor for Kanagawa, a guy by the name of Hiro Watanabe, the governor of Yamanashi was from India. And though the Japanese had basically administered the colonies the entire time, they'd never before installed governors, leaving it more or less up to self-rule as long as the tax monies kept rolling in. Additionally, the princes of the seats were following the emperor's lead, who was following the diets, whose representatives to the UN had voted against the whole scheme. Admittedly, partly in selfishness, they were getting actual tax dollars, while the rest of Earth's nations weren't. But they also didn't like the idea of strengthening the UN to the powers they had gained. Now, during this period, Watanabe did what few other governors did. He declared his loyalty to the world he was on, and then stood for popular elections. Which, because of this move, and because of his even-handedness prior, which had proved him to be a fair governor, he won. The people of Kanagawa had no problem with him, or with his administration. They had a problem with who his loyalties were to. And now that was taken care of. But the Yamanashi governor was basically escorted to a cargo ship and asked not to come back. And, in the interim, the holder of the Cherry Blossom seat assumed his duties, advised by a congress of elected officials from across the planet. Then he gave up this role as soon as a new planetary governor was elected. But, by both the backing of the revolution and the administration of Yamanashi, it made the people of both worlds pretty much love the royal family more than they ever thought was possible. I mean, damn, just look at how great these guys are! And this is even reflected in the way that the federal government recognizes them. According to the Republican Constitution, each world was to establish a republican form of government, which, according to the understanding of what that meant, should have meant an upper and lower house of a legislature, a governor, and then an independent court. Instead, Yamanashi and Kanagawa established constitutional monarchies, ruled technically by the Emperor of Japan or his heirs in his stead, and formed a one-house legislature, of which the leader would become prime minister. The courts were still independent, though each was technically approved by the royal seat on their respective planet. And though this wasn't what the Constitution specifically had written into it, it was accepted as basically good enough. Which now leads us into the problem of who got what seat. As I said in the beginning, the crown prince was to get the Cherry Blossom seat, and the second in line, the Mountaintop. And this was all well and good when the Diet on Earth set the whole thing up. The problem now was twofold. First, the Mountaintop seat was, well, way nicer. And second, once cut off from Earth, who would enforce this whole thing? I mean, it was one thing for the crown prince to have a son in 2140, when Earth and the colonies were still on speaking terms, have him come of age and then take over the Mountaintop seat while his father held the Cherry Blossom seat. You just sent those other relatives packing back to Japan. I mean, that son wasn't exactly looking forward to taking his place on the Cherry Blossom seat after living on Kanagawa, but hey, at least his son would have it for a while. But once things with Earth were basically cut off, what do you do with those relatives then? And at first the answer was a little contentious. I mean, the holder was a royal. Are you just going to send him packing? And if you are, where to? And if not, who was going to pick up the bill? The people on these worlds might love their royals, but there's a limit to how many cousins to the crown prince they're really going to pay for. So after the revolution, when these things started to come to a head, a deal was worked out. The crown prince's younger brother, who held the Mountaintop seat, would continue to have it and would pass it down to his oldest child, by this time male or female, while the crown prince's eldest would hold the Cherry Blossom seat. Should either not have an heir to take over, the other house would supply one, but the Mountaintop seat would forever be beholden to whatever the Cherry Blossom seat decreed, as it was the senior seat. And so, it worked out. And both houses ended up becoming cousins of one another over a few generations. And it solved the problem for the taxpayers. You weren't in line for the seat? Yeah, you got a job. But on the off chance your cousin on the other seat might, say, die, hey, who knows? You might get one hell of a retirement package. So, after the revolution, where did Yamanashi and Kanagawa fit in the whole Galileo and Troy are liberal to Columbus and Algarabia are conservative spectrum within Republican politics? And the answer lies solidly in the middle. The truth is, it's like Japan today. There are things that go on in Japan that would freak the living hell out of Western conservatives. But there are things that you do not mess with in terms of tradition. And the new Nippon system ended up pretty much the same way. In fact, in the next age, we'll actually see Kanagawa and Yamanashi flip-flop in major ways on a major question put to the Republican Congress. Not because they're wishy-washy in any way, but because they'll default to conservatism when asked, but after evidence to the contrary is given, they'll find themselves fairly open-minded. And of course, I'm speaking in very broad strokes here. Just like in every society, be it 10 people to the combined 50 million they'd have after independence, there were people who believed strongly one way or the other. Now, one last topic before we wrap this up. Baseball. Or really, colonial baseball. A topic that I'd given serious consideration to doing an entire podcast ep on, but that I've decided to leave alone because I think it's my own private obsession. Like, the fact that the shipper's favorite game on board is cribbage? But this, I thought, deserved a special mention. Colonial baseball is generally believed to have begun in 2129, when the independent Galileo and Athena leagues played one another in the first Colonial Series, as it was called. The Athena League dated back to 2125, and the Galileo League was only 2 years old at that point. However, the Japanese League, as it would come to be called when it first joined colonial baseball in 2132, actually started 10 years before Athena's did. The Japanese that settled out in the colonies were baseball crazy, and their first pastime was the establishment of baseball clubs. So, despite what you might hear me say in future episodes, keep that in mind. Colonial baseball might have started in 2129, but Japanese baseball is actually older. Now, why this is the case might not be much of a mystery. With the insularity of Japanese culture, they didn't have much of an interest in playing or even encouraging other teams to start outside of their system. They saw their version as the pure version, and because they didn't offer translations for their games, no one really wanted to watch baseball in a language they couldn't understand, even once the content satellites were established, like we talked about in episode 2.9. It was there. It was just mostly ignored if you weren't Japanese. But then the Colonial Series happened, and it got attention throughout the Star Cluster. Two leagues with four teams each, and they called their championship the Colonial Series? I mean, hey, I love baseball, but it takes some hubris to take a basically American baseball thing with a single team in Canada and call it the World Series. But Yamanashi and Kanagawa weren't about to let the same thing slide, so they asked to join Colonial Baseball, and they did in the first expansion in 2132. And because these two worlds could supply 12 teams on their own, it required the new Galileo Athena League to expand to let New Chicago in to add four more to their side just to even things out. And then the Japanese teams would go on to become a dominant force in baseball. And with that little tidbit, okay. I don't know that any of this will come up directly in the next season, but the new Nipponese worlds are so damned interesting, I just felt I couldn't let them slide this season. And I hope that now you agree. But if you have any thoughts, questions, comments, you're always welcome to email them to me at urspodcast@gmail.com, and I'll do my best to answer. Or you can drop by the site, unifiedrepublicofstars.com, and add to the subject if you think of something neat or a detail that would help bring this aspect more fully to life. And as always, I'm social. You can find me at Republic of Stars on Twitter or on Facebook by searching Unified Republic of Stars. Or if you really want to help us out, leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you're listening to this. As always, our theme is by Ryan Hauser, and any score is by Darren Solomon. Next time, unless I get inspired again or unless I get a suggestion that really needs to be discussed, I think we're going to wrap up this season with one more rivalries ep, just because I think it'll be fun. Emra's Paradise versus the Island Group. Until next time.